Chapter. Oh, before I forget, I'll get the paper topics and stuff up onto the website by tomorrow. So take a peek for that. Yeah, that's the update on that one. So there we go. Chapter 3 takes us into classical conditioning. So we're going to take a look at some of the basic systems here. The chapter 4 deals more with some of the theoretical aspects. So here we go. This goes back to good old Pavlov, Ivan Pavlov, medical physiologist. His father was a Russian priest. He was initially destined for the seminary, but didn't really take with him. Instead, went on and became a doctor. And specifically, he was a research physician. He was really geared towards medical research there with a physiological bent. And he very early on got interested in digestion. And in particular, the reflexive responses of digestion. So things like salivation and releases of stomach acid in the presence of food, these sorts of things. What was kind of important for a lot of his work is up until this point, it had been rather difficult to take ongoing data collection samples of things like these reflexively released digestive secretions. You could take them temporarily, but it was they had a hard time having subjects that could survive or not experience a lot of discomfort by, for long-term recording. And so one of the things that Pavlov invented was these things called a fistula for the salivary ducts. And so they surgically implanted cannulas into the salivary glands such that instead of releasing the saliva into the mouth, the saliva was rerouted through a little duct, a fistula, into a vial for collection. So it's been an example of one of the dogs with the permanently mounted saliva collecting device there. And when not in use, the this little tube and the little vial here just got removed. It just be removed. So the dogs could run around, and when they were normally, you know, eating food normally, this could be turned off so the saliva is not being dripping out onto the floor or anything like that. Some people often say, well, this must have been terribly cruel of Pavlov to do this to his dogs. He seemed to actually like his dogs. They seemed to take very good care of them. There's a website out there. If you search around, you can find it where there's pictures of his dogs. They've all got names. They're not just, you know, numbers. Dog 36, dog ZQ12. They've all got names. They all seem to be fairly healthy. The pictures are all taken, outside. The dog's outside, getting a chance to run around and do things. So, I don't think he was, the ethics of the late 19th century are clearly different from the ethics of today. But the dogs weren't continually confined to small metal cages or anything like that. He seemed to take the best care that he could of them. And that's a good scientific reason for that. As we said before, if you're not taking good care of your non-human animal subjects, you really can't trust the results that you're getting from the research. Anyways, so he does this. He gets interested in these reflexes. And fairly accidentally, two of his graduate students stumble upon classical conditioning. They don't really understand what it means, and that's where Pavlov's important. He makes the connection. He realizes that he's now getting reflexive responses, salivary responses, to things that are not food. So some of his students are doing things like giving the dogs different types of substances, sand or water that's been colored black or various amounts of food. And what they discover is that after a while of doing this, the dog starts salivating before any substance is even put into their mouth. You know, drip, 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 drip down into the test tube vial there on the fistula. And to his students, this seems like a problem. It seems something wrong with the dogs. From Pavlov's point of view, he says, no, let's figure out what's going on. And it turns out the dogs have made associations, at least many of them, between the white lab coats that were being worn by the researchers and the food. So anybody that's got a white lab coat, the dogs have come to learn, is that's who's going to be feeding them. and in this preparatory manner, they start salivating in response to seeing the white lab coat. This leads Pavlov to come up with some names. So he says, right, we've got what should be called unconditional stimuli and responses. He says, unconditional stimuli and responses are those for which their properties are not dependent upon prior learning. We might say these are innate elements. So a stimulus that will innately produce a response doesn't have to be trained. Okay, so this would be our unconditional stimulus and our unconditional response. Now, we now know today that unconditional stimuli and unconditional responses are part of a reflex network, so part of a reflex arc. Pavlov said there's also, then, the learning comes in with what he calls conditional stimuli and responses. Now, he picked the word on purpose. It says conditional in the sense of it is dependent upon. Now, unfortunately, when his work was first translated into English in 1927, the translator goofed. And instead of writing conditional, unconditional, and conditional, wrote unconditioned ED and conditioned ED. In other words, you've had to condition this. And that's not quite what he meant. He actually intentionally meant that it is dependent. It is dependent upon learning. It's only going to occur. So your conditional stimuli, conditional responses, these will only occur after the learning has been performed. And so what we're seeing here is an association between the stimuli. So the lab coat, white lab coat, becomes associated with the food. The lab coat is our conditional stimulus, the CS. It gets paired, it gets associated with the unconditional stimulus, the US, and comes to produce a conditional response. It's a response that's only produced after this learning has occurred. So this is how we get our US, our UR, our CS, and our CR. Now, of course, your UR and your CR are not always going to be the same. In much of this salivary work that Pavlov was doing, they were remarkably similar, right? Salivation with respect to food, salivation with respect to whatever the conditional stimulus was. But in other cases, we can get conditional stimuli that are, in fact, even completely opposite to whatever the unconditional response would be. So, in terms of classical conditioning, classical learning, or sometimes also still called Pavlovian learning, we've got a few components here. First, there has to be a reflex involved. If you don't have a reflex in there, you don't have classical conditioning. Maybe you got operant conditioning. Maybe you just got habituation and sensitization. Okay, I mean, habituation and sensitization involve reflexes, but they don't involve the association with some other conditional stimulus. So first thing to check for, you know, is this classical conditioning? Is there a reflex in there, something that is reflexively produced? The subject's behavior here as well, you've got to remember, the subject's behavior is not causing the delivery of an unconditional stimulus. If you have a situation where the subject's behavior produces the unconditional stimulus, produces that outcome, produces the food or produces the shock, then you've got operant conditioning. Right? In the presence of the stimulus, if you make this response, then there is this outcome. Okay, that takes us into operant. So we need a reflex system in here, and we need some other stimulus or stimuli to be associated with the unconditional stimulus. So if you've got that going on, we've got classical conditioning. We've met the basic elements of classical conditioning here. Now, there's a lot of different ways that you can set up your conditioning arrangements. So you can do what's called short delay. I didn't label this here. Your green is your conditional stimulus. The red is your unconditional stimulus. If the line is flat, no stimulus is presented. As the line steps up, that's when our stimulus is being presented. And then when it drops back down, the stimulus is terminated. So in short delay, we present the stimulus, our conditional stimulus, for a short time before the US is delivered. Okay? And there is no gap or temporal separation between our CS and US. In other words, they coincide, they overlap. Different people do short delay in slightly different ways. The way I've just drawn it here, the US is presented just a little bit before the CS terminates. Other people depict it and actually run it with the US presented as the CS is being terminated. Doesn't really matter. The point here is the conditional stimulus is presented for a brief period of time before the US is presented. Contrast this with long delay. In long delay, your conditional stimulus is presented for, surprise, surprise, a long period of time before the unconditional stimulus is then presented as well. Trace, in trace conditioning, the CS is presented, the CS is terminated. Some time passes, this is called the trace interval, and then the US is presented. Okay, so there's actually a temporal discontinuity between the CS and the US. So in this case, you have to, it's called trace because there has to be a memory trace, to use the early 20th century terminology there. You have to be able to somehow trace the memory into your brain systems and remember that the CS was presented previously. In simultaneous conditioning, your CS and your US are presented at exactly the same time. So as your CS is being presented, so is your US. And they terminate at the same time. Generally, they terminate at the same time as well. In backwards, we do something a little bit different. In backwards, we present the unconditional stimulus first, some time passes, and then we present the conditional stimulus. Now, so, you know, in terms of this, which of these things is not like the other? I guess backwards conditioning is least like the others here, in that the US is actually coming before the CS. All other things being equal, short delay conditioning is probably the most efficient or effective way of actually generating a conditional response. Like I said, these are all other things being equal. If you had to, you know, probably in, whatever, 90% of the cases, this is going to be the most efficient way to do this. If your goal is just to produce a conditional response, set up a short delay situation. How long should the CS be on before the US is presented? Depends. If you're dealing with like a skeletal muscular response, you can get away with something like maybe half a second to a second, and then you present the US. If you're dealing with something that's like a blood pressure change or digestion changes or something like that, salivary response, you might have your CS presented maybe 5 to 30 seconds before the US is delivered. So it can be a bit longer. But in either case, it's a relatively short period. And this tends to work quite well. In long delay and trace conditioning, these aren't as effective as short delay. You can get conditioning this way, obviously, but it's not usually as easy. There needs to be two things happening here. One, there needs to be a keeping track of time. So one of the things that classical conditioning does is allow us to prepare for upcoming future events. So ring a bell, put food in the dog's mouth, right? Standard Pavlovian system here. If we're ringing a bell on long delay for 5 minutes before we're going to put food in the dog's mouth, there's no point for the dog to start salivating as soon as the bell is ringing. He's going, it's leaking out the side. Right? He's got a mouthful of drool. He's dribbling everywhere. That's just messy and wasteful. So instead, the dog's going to need to keep track of time. So he's going to need to say, all right, probably don't need to start salivating for 4.5, 4.75 minutes after the bell is presented. Well, that means you got to be keeping track of the time. And, you know, dogs are typically not given wristwatches. Okay, so, you know, well, second hand has to go around 4 times. And, right, even if he did give them the watches there, they're probably going to have a hard time. They'll just try, can I eat it? Is it food? Right? It's not going to work. So, you have to use a biological time estimation system, and it might be a bit off. Okay, so this makes it a little more difficult. Same thing with the trace conditioning. Okay, you need to be able to go, I've got to wait however much time before I start making that conditional response. Second thing here is that in both cases, there could be other stimuli that are more salient that are presented more contiguously with respect to the unconditional stimulus. And these other stimuli could either serve to start to become conditional stimuli of their own, or they may just make it seem more random to the subject, such that there seems to be a non-contingent presentation of stimuli with the U.S. So that can make the learning a little more difficult, retard the learning there as well. And finally, in the case of trace, you've actually got to keep a memory going. It's like, yep, there's a CS. Yep, it's terminated. A few minutes pass. Was there a bell ring? I can't really completely remember. Okay, so you've got to keep something going in your short-term memory as well. So both of those are a bit more difficult than short delay. Simultaneous conditioning, most studies find that it's actually probably the worst way to actually try to set up conditioning. You can get conditioning to occur this way, but it's difficult. It tends to produce fairly weak conditional responses just in response to the CS. Look at it this way. Again, in terms of the preparedness interpretation, right? The CS is there to let you know the U.S. is coming. Let's say our U.S. is going to be a foot shock and our CS is going to be a buzzer. So this case here, we present the buzzer at the same time that we're shocking your foot. It's like, yeah, way to prepare for that. I mean, you can't, right? You're already getting shocked, and there's a buzzer going. Yeah? Could the buzzer sensitize them? Potentially, which would make it even more painful. So that would probably be it's what we call in science a double whammy. That would probably make things even worse. Not only are you getting shocked, you're being sensitized to the shock. Yeah. So I could see that potentially happening there as well. You get a bit of sensitization coming in. But in any event, you can't prepare for it in this sense. So it's not a great way to do classical conditioning. If classical conditioning has that advantage in terms of, you know, biologically speaking, what's it good for? Well, it's good for allowing subjects to prepare for upcoming events, or informing them the absence of an upcoming event. Then simultaneous, give you another technical term here that we use, simultaneous conditioning sucks. Okay, so technical science term there. It is not an effective way to produce classical conditioning. Now we come to backwards. A lot of studies have been done on backwards conditioning. And of the five arrangements here, this is perhaps, in some ways, both the most interesting and the most frustrating, because the results with respect to backwards conditioning studies are extremely inconsistent. Short delay, long delay, trace, simultaneous, pretty much all of the studies show a fairly general agreement. I mean, there's little variation here or there, but, yeah, short delay, generally going to be most effective. Long delay and trace, yeah, okay, not brilliant. Simultaneous, really bad. Not a lot of quibbling on this. There's a few situations where you can, you know, make a trace a little bit better than you might expect and whatnot. But in backwards conditioning, I mean, some studies find that you just don't get conditional responses produced at all. Some studies find that you actually get the CS actually is turned into an inhibitory conditional stimulus. The CS actually comes to predict when you're not going to get the U.S. And then finally, sort of penultimately, some studies find that you do in fact get a excitatory conditional stimulus. Not very many of those studies. And there's even been a couple of studies that have found that in the same study, sometimes the CS ends up being excitatory, sometimes it ends up being inhibitory with respect to different subjects. So we get a whole range of stuff going on here. Early on, backwards conditioning was not looked at as much because, like, yeah, this doesn't work very well. But more recently, people have started to get very interested in it because we get some extremely variable outcomes with it. And a lot of it seems to depend particularly on these little details in terms of how you are executing the study, exactly what methodologies are you using. And that can then be used to get some very sort of fine control elucidation of how classical conditioning components work. You start combining this with modern techniques in neurophysiology, and this can be very potentially interesting for learning a bit more about how our nervous system actually deals with the learning components here. So anyways, these are the basic temporal arrangements. Now, a few other terms to bring in here just to remind you of these. A conditioning trial. That's each and every CS-US pairing in your study. Okay, so every time you present a CS and a US, regardless of, I mean, in backwards conditioning, there's your CS-US pairing. Okay, it's the US-CS pairing. Okay, there's our simultaneous, you know. Okay, doesn't matter if they're separated or whatnot. They're the stimuli that go together. So that's your conditioning trial. Intertrial interval, time from the end of one trial to the start of the next. So the end of your, you know, in four of those cases, you know, once the US is terminated to the next CS presentation. In the case of backwards, it would be the termination of the CS to the presentation of the next US. And finally, interstimulus interval, the time from the start of the first stimulus in the pair to the second stimulus in the pair on a trial. So if we have something like this set up, here would be our, you know, a conditioning trial. Here we would have an intertrial interval. And here we would have an interstimulus interval. Okay? And, you know, in different studies you can play around with all these things. You can manipulate things. The interstimulus interval, you know, that can become quite significant. A number of conditioning trials, hey, just the more conditioning trials you do, typically the more you're learning. Intertrial interval. This is actually related to the number of conditioning trials in overall period of time. I mean, right? If you have an intertrial interval of 6 days, in other words, you're only doing one trial every 6 days, it's going to take you a long time to do 100 trials. All right? If you've got intertrial intervals of 2 seconds, right, you may have issues getting into extreme depletion of neurotransmitters, fatigue, all these issues, which may then interfere with the association learning process. So, you know, depending on the subjects you're working with, depending on what your CS and US actually is, different intertrial intervals might be the most optimal for each situation. Usually, intertrial intervals of 10, 15 to 30 seconds are not uncommon. Now, you got some stuff, let's say. We've given you some stuff and some subjects and some equipment, and you're going to go off and you're going to conduct some classical conditioning studies. Woohoo! How do you actually find out if you've really produced any learning? Standard way to do this is to use what's called a test trial, or also called a probe trial. Basically, the most common way to do it is just give a trial where you only present the conditional stimulus by itself. So you do not give the US. And if you get a conditional response, if you get a response occurring, well, it would have to be due to the CS then. Okay? In some cases, like, you know, if you've got something where it's possible to clearly separate the occurrence of the CR from the occurrence of the UR, you may present your CS and then your US, but if they overlap, if your CR and your UR are kind of overlapping, how much of the saliva is due to the CS, how much is due to the US, this can get kind of difficult sometimes. Easiest way to do it is simply to use a probe trial. Now, you've got to be a little bit careful with this. If you give too many probe trials, in sequence, if you present too many at a time, you can start getting into extinction effects. Because remember, extinction, occurs in classical conditioning when the CS is presented without the US. So if you go, right, I've done 20 learning trials, 20 conditioning trials, I will now do 20 test trials in a row. Yeah. It's like, funny, they don't seem to be making a CR anymore. It's like, yeah, it's because you extinguished it. How about just doing maybe like 4 or something? It's like, oh yeah, okay, could do that. All right. So periodically give a test trial or a probe trial. What might you end up measuring? Oh, yep.
I'm just curious what that has to do with, like, when you're training a dog, you have to reward them, right? Like food or whatever it is.
Right.
Then eventually you don't have to give them food every time they do something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you're trying to train a dog to do something, you start out giving it food, but then you can gradually reduce this so that you're not giving food as much or every time. Okay. It's probably operant conditioning that you're dealing with there. But what you're doing is, it's called stretching the ratio. So what happens, if you just did it suddenly in operant conditioning, if you went, right, we will now only reinforce you once every 50 times, the dog will extinguish. But if it's, you know, you've been doing reinforcement every time, and then it's like, okay, we've done, you know, this 20 or 30 times where it gets reinforced every single time, now we'll do it every other time. And the dog initially, it does get a bit of extinction. There's a bit of extinction, but it goes, wait, I'm learning something new. Now it's not every time, it's every other time. As long as the treat is still motivating enough, it'll keep going with this. So, yep. But you can gradually reduce that, or you can start making the amount of treat you give the dog smaller each time. It's like, here you go, you get it every time. It's like, oh boy, says the dog, and it just, you know, start with a big bone, and it goes down to a little tiny bit of food, so... A lot of animals had a hard time dealing with number, right? Some, you know, for some animals it's like none, one, two, three, lots! Okay, and they can't really count beyond that. So, you know, it's like this one thing is the same as this other one thing in some cases. So, but yeah, that's more of an operant situation there. But we'll come to that. We will get to that. Train of thought, reboarding at the station. Woo-woo, all aboard. Okay, here we go, magnitude. Right, so various things you can look for here in terms of your test trials. What might you be measuring? You might measure the magnitude. So how much of the conditional response actually occurs? Well, I mean, you got a test tube attached to a fistula in a dog's jaw. Pretty easy to measure the amount of saliva that's been produced here. I mean, what's the magnitude of your conditional response? 6 drops of saliva. Okay, do some more training. What's the magnitude? 18 drops of saliva. There we go. Okay, very straightforward. Probability. What is the probability that a CS is going to produce a CR? So we do a test trial, you know. Does anything happen? Maybe not. So in this case here, you'd be, say, taking and summing a few test trials. So we put them in blocks. So in the first block of 10 test trials, we only had a probability that a CR be produced of 30%. But after we did more conditioning, a block of 10 test trials, our probability of having a conditional response produced to a CS was 80%. Okay. So we can look at changes in probability across conditioning trials there. In some cases, latency. How soon does a CR occur after the CS? We talked about reflexes. We talked about the latency from Sherrington. So give a very light, just barely crosses threshold, poke the dog's paw. There's going to be some latency delay before it moves its paw. Give it a stronger poke, that latency goes down. So again, we could see things like that as well in various, depending on what we're testing. So you could measure how long does it take before the CR occurs when the CS is presented. Okay. One thing that we have to be a little bit concerned about is what's called pseudo-conditioning. There's other things that can lead to an increase in a response. And pseudo-conditioning is one of them. Essentially, it's a sensitization process. So we get an increase in response due to just the unconditional stimulus. Okay, so we're talking about test trials here, probe trials, where you just present the CS by itself. But in many cases, you can also look for, say, differences in magnitude. You can measure the magnitude of an unconditional response. And then if you do a standard sort of trial where there's your CS and the US, if you get more of that response, right, much more than just when you're presented with the US alone, you might see, yeah, see that extra amount, that extra magnitude is due to the conditional response there as well. But in some cases, just being presented, you know, just the very fact that you've been presented with a number of times with the unconditional stimulus, this might sensitize your system. And so, in fact, some of the magnitude that you're getting from your response may be due to just sensitization. So you let's say that we get some pseudo-conditioning happening, we get some sensitization. Let's say we even just do a test trial and say, ah, I got, you know, 12 drops of saliva. Okay, one needs to be careful there and say, is the 12 drops, is that just due to the conditional response? Or is some of this because the system has become sensitized by the US that you've been using during the conditioning trials? All right, so you need to control for that as well. So ways of doing that is you follow your test trials for a while. If, you know, you start out getting a higher, for example, magnitude of conditional response, and then it drops down with later test trials. Remember, sensitization tends to wear off relatively quickly. You might go, oh yeah, some of that higher amount, that was probably due to some sensitization. After that's worn off, yeah, okay, here's what the actual conditional response is. Here's our actual amount that's being produced through the CR and not through the just additional sensitization of the system. Okay, so that's something to think about there. Keep in mind. Now, there are in any sort of between group study, we will need to have a control group, and we'll need to have one or more experimental groups. Question is, how do we actually go about producing controls in classical conditioning studies? One of the original approaches is called the random control process. So in this case, we have an experimental group, and the experimental group will get a certain number of CS-US pairings, okay? However many that is, 30. So the CS gets paired with the US 30 times. The random control methodology says, in our control group, we'll do the same number of CS and US presentations, so 30 CS presentations and 30 US presentations, but we'll randomize the order. So it could be, you know, CS, CS, US, 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 CS, US, CS, 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 US, CS, CS, US, 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 et cetera, until you get up to 30 of each. This was used for quite a while, although a while back, some studies were showing that you may still get associative learning in this. And so this may not be an ideal control to see whether or not you get responses to the CS on its own. Because even this randomized sequencing, you know, these things are still going together more often than they're not. It's in a session, if you will. A more recent experimental methodology for developing controls in between groups studies is to use what's called the explicitly unpaired control. In this case here, your experimental group is given a certain number of CS-US pairings, so just the same as in our random control approach. And the control group, again, it gets the same number of CSs, and the same number of USs as experimental group, but these are presented far enough apart that it's expected this should prevent any sort of association being formed. In some cases, some researchers even separate the presentations, the CS and the US, into completely different sessions on different dates. All right. So in the control group, they'll get some CSs on one day, then Next day, they'll get some USs. The day after that, might be USs, might be CSs, until they get up to the same number as CS and US pairings as the experimental group did. And by spacing these far enough apart, the idea here is it's going to be really difficult. It's going to be such a violation of contiguity that we're not going to have to worry about associative learning between the CSs and USs. Okay, so there's different techniques for using those. Another thing here to look at are the different types of conditional stimuli. Now, by this, I don't mean what's the stimulus that we're using, a tone or a light or a vibration or something like that. What we mean here is whether or not a conditional stimulus takes on what we call an excitatory or inhibitory role. Excitatory conditional stimuli, usually abbreviated CS+, it's the most common and standard usage now, is a conditional stimulus that predicts the occurrence of the unconditional stimulus. And what a CS plus is going to do is activate behavior that is specifically related to the US. Now, again, that doesn't mean that our CR that gets activated by the CS plus is, by necessity, going to be the same as our UR. It could, in fact, be a compensatory conditional response, so it could actually be a conditional response that's opposite. If the US causes blood pressure to go up, the CS plus could actually cause the blood pressure to go down. But the point here is the behavior that is being produced by our CS plus is actually directly related to the occurrence of the unconditional stimulus. Okay? In the case of an inhibitory conditional stimulus, or CS minus, in this case here, our CS is predicting the non-occurrence of the unconditional stimulus. And what an inhibitory conditional stimulus, CS minus, does is it suppresses the behavior that's related to the unconditional stimulus. So if the CS plus is producing a conditional response of salivation, CS minus will suppress or inhibit, hence inhibitory, will inhibit the behavior related to the unconditional stimulus. Now, we don't really have to talk too much about excitatory conditional stimuli. That's pretty well known and straightforward. But we're going to talk a bit about inhibitory conditioning here. We said with classical conditioning, preparedness is one explanation for this. Sure, you got a puff of air, being directed at the eye, and if there's a conditional stimulus that predicts when this puff of air is coming, then it lets you blink the eye early so that you don't get blasted in the eyeball with a puff of air. Great, that's got a fairly obvious adaptive survival value there. But what about in the inhibitory conditioning situation? Here, the CS is predicting a non-event. It's the non-occurrence of an event. How is this, perhaps adaptive? Well, the way to look at this is perhaps best easiest to understand in terms of looking at aversive situations, aversive events. We know that unpredicted aversive events are actually more stressful. If I were to have been particularly nasty, I'm not, but if I were, I could pass this off as a pedagogical training tool. So if I'd gotten them to wire all of your chairs with, instead of foot shocks, ass shock delivery devices, right? And then, randomly up here, I just, every now and then, for no apparent reason, push a button causing one of you to get a shock to your butt, this would be a pretty stressful class, right? You're never knowing when that's going to happen. As opposed to, it's like, okay, class is starting. Everyone ready for the butt shock for the day? Yes? Okay. There we go. Good. We're done with it. Let's go on. Right? But if you don't know when you're going to get your butt shock, right? It's like, yes, along with the tuition for this course, you get a shock to your ass every time you come in. But here's the surprise. You don't know when during the class it is. Yeah, how much do you think you're going to be paying attention to what I'm lecturing? Right? Not that much. It's like, did his hand move towards the keyboard? Is it going to be me? Oh, somebody in the back row. Oh, thank goodness. That means it's mine still coming. Oh, it'd be fair. I'd have to shock all of you every day. Okay. Anyway, that's pretty unpredictable. That's pretty stressful. All right? So, that was hopefully an amusing example of this. Here's something that's not amusing. Cases where we've got child abuse. Children that are living in abusive households where they may be beaten or abused at pretty much any time without indication. These children are under massive amounts of stress. Okay? This leads to huge psychological problems. That's where we get counseling, you know, the necessity of counseling there. So, unpredictable events, unpredictable aversive events, these are more stressful than predictable aversive events. Kransk and colleagues in 95 measured the general anxiety levels in subjects that have panic disorders. Okay, so subjects that have panic disorders, they tend to have panic attacks on a fairly regular basis here. So they worked with people that have these panic disorders. And in some cases, for people that have that are afflicted with panic disorders, sometimes they know when a panic attack is coming on. They've learned, if you will, contextual cues or stimuli. It's like, oh, my boss is going to be yelling at me about something, or oh, it's a really hot day, or whatever it happens to be. In some cases, they're able to actually predict when a panic attack is likely to occur. So we've got predictable and unpredictable panic attacks. Sometimes they just get hit with a panic attack that didn't see it coming. So Kransk and colleagues asked their subjects to give before and after anxiety ratings. So after you have the attack, go back and think, what was your general level of anxiety before the attack, and what's the level after the attack is initiated for predictable and unpredictable attacks. And they got data very much like this. So in terms of this beforehand, the unpredictable and predictable anxiety attacks, about the same. I know this looks a bit different, but really statistically, these are fairly similar here. It's not really much difference before. But in terms of unpredictable attacks, these generate much more general anxiety. Their anxiety levels are much higher if they couldn't prepare for it. If these are predictable attacks, they experience anxiety during the attack, but it's less severe afterwards. Their general level of anxiety is not as high. So the post-attack anxiety, and these are significantly different. In the predictable attack, it's significantly lower than in the unpredictable attack. So again, this is suggesting here that being clobbered with some sort of unpredictable aversive event can be quite stressful. Some stress is necessary in life, right? I mean, if you have the only way that you are experiencing absolutely no stress at all is if you are dead. Right? There is no stress on an inanimate system. So you need some stress. I mean, some stress. That's just life. Okay. But extreme stressors, that's, here's another science word for you, bad. Okay, we'll call that bad, technical term. Right. So the ability then to predict aversive events would also allow you to predict the lack of an aversive event. If you can do one, if you can predict when an aversive event is coming, you should also be able to use those stimuli to predict when you're not going to have an aversive event coming, or at least hopefully. You know. Where does this show up? Stress management techniques. This has been utilized very heavily in stress management therapy, stress management sessions and whatnot. It's recognized that you can't eliminate all of the stressors in life. Okay, but if you... there's various types of stress management techniques here, but one of them is to put in mandated, if you will, periods of safety. So times when the person is not going to be hit with a stressor. So, you know, if my door is closed, leave me alone. I will not pick up the phone. I will not answer the roughy knock. That's it. If I'm taking my 15-minute safe time break, that's it. Nothing bad is going to happen to me. And if you know that, you go into your office, you close the door, it's like, yep, this is my safe time. Nothing bad's going to happen here. I can predict that. I can predict that I can manage to eliminate, you can't eliminate perhaps the stressors for the rest of the day, but in that 15 minutes, you got the control. Okay, you can predict nothing stressful is going to occur. All right. Now, studies of this show that this actually reduces the overall stress. And when the stressors are presented, you know, once you leave your predictable period of safety, okay, when you come off break and do encounter stressful events, they're actually less stressful. Okay, so it reduces the overall amount of stress, the responses to the other stressors during the day. So, interesting little issues there. Okay, now, so in terms of inhibitory conditional stimuli, learning about something that's a non-event is going to, again, be very useful. Being able to predict when you're not going to receive an aversive could be very, very beneficial to an organism there. Now, we can produce, I mean, we tend to usually talk about CS minuses for aversive stimuli, but you can also produce them for appetitive stimuli as well. It's just generally most experimental studies, again, given issues of application, you know, real-world application, are more concerned with the aversive. So the vast majority of the research that's been done on CS minuses deals with setting them up to using CS minuses to indicate the lack of an aversive event. But there's no reason why you can't do them with appetitive things as well. When the light is green, you get, you know, if you're a rat, in the presence of the green light, hey, there's a rat yummy. If there's a green light and a red light, oh, no rat yummy. Okay, so you find in the presence of the green light, salivation. In the presence of the red and the green light, no salivation. So in that case, the U.S. is appetitive. It's not aversive. You know, it saves you salivating when you don't need to. So that's probably a good thing from an energy perspective of an organism. All right. Now, in either case, regardless, the only way we can get a CS minus, the only way we can get inhibitory conditioning is if we've also got an excitatory context here. Right. So we can't do something where we never present a U.S. Right? Beep, and nothing ever happens. So what's the U.S.? Oh, there is no U.S. So what's that beep doing? Well, it's an inhibitory conditional stimulus telling you that you're not going to get the U.S. But I never get the U.S. Exactly. It's good, isn't it? Worked nicely. No. What you're doing there is just probably habituating that beep. It's like, oh, nothing happened. Yeah, okay. So you get into habituation. So you've got to be able to produce conditioned inhibition, you have to have excitatory conditioning as well. So you cannot have a CS minus unless you've also got a CS plus. The reverse is not true. You can have excitatory conditional stimuli without a CS minus. Okay? Make sense? One person nodded. Good enough. I'll go with that. If one person understands, I'm sure everybody else got that equally well. Moving on. So, how do we go about doing this? Various techniques for producing inhibitory conditional stimuli. Pavlov. Pavlov knew about this. Pavlov had a technique. This is Pavlov's technique. He would do two different types of trials. We'll call them trial type A and trial type B, largely because that's what your textbook calls them. So it's nice and consistent. In trial type A, we present a CS plus and a US, but no CS minus. Okay, so on trial type A, this is really just our standard excitatory conditioning. CS plus paired with the U.S. And I'm just doing it here in a sort of short delay process, but you could do trace, you could do long delay, you know, whatever. Okay? Just depicting it as short delay. On trial type B, we present the CS plus and the CS minus, but no U.S. Okay? So, green light on, red light off, you get the food. Green light on, red light on, no food. Okay? And then, of course, you're going to randomize the trial type presentations, right? So you're, you know, A, A, B, A, B, 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 A, B, A, B, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? You don't want to just do, well, let's do 30 A's first, and then we'll do 30 B's, right? You're going to randomize that, mix it up, okay? So that's the basic protocol. Still used. Very, very successful protocol for establishing conditioned inhibition. But there's other ways you can do it as well. You can do a negative contingency protocol. You could do something like this, where there's no correlation between the CS and the US. So in this case here, like I said, we violate contingency. We produce a random correlation. Okay? So there's no relationship between them. In that case, whatever CS we present, so a tone comes on, at some point, a US is delivered, shock, whatever, tone's on at some point, shock's on. There's no relationship between them. They have nothing to do with one another. So that's what we call a negative contingency protocol, or just a non-contingent or a random presentation. So in this sense here, we say we've got the CS minus there, and it's not linked up. So what the CS minus is telling you is when you've got a CS minus, you're definitely not going to get the US, right? They don't go together. At no point here is the CS coincide with the US. So you know that at least. Now, remember I said that you have to have a CS plus to be able to produce a CS minus? If this is all we do, if we're only presenting the stimulus that we're going to turn to CS minus, where's our CS plus? Well, the context cues may serve as a CS plus. So if you've got a pigeon in the testing chamber, and if the testing chamber is the only place where the US is delivered, then the attributes of the testing chamber, the context cues, the environmental stimuli, these actually would become the CS plus. That's the idea. So the only place this US is delivered is within this testing chamber. Therefore, those serve as the contextual cues. It says the pigeon comes to learn, ah, yes, when I am in here, I will be getting the US. So that becomes the excitatory conditional stimuli. And at any time this tone is presented, I definitely know for a fact that I will not receive the unconditional stimulus when I've got the tone going. Okay. You can make it even more explicit. You know, I didn't draw this, but I wish I had another sort of blackboard or something going on over here. But you can make it a little more explicit by always sticking, say, you know, you could always do a CS plus with the US. So, you know, just before every US, there is some green light that comes on, for example. So a little green light there, a little green light here, a little green light here. Okay? So you make it even more explicit. In that case, we can have our green light as a CS plus, and then, you know, CS minuses just kind of show up whenever in a random pattern. Again, as long as they don't really overlap with your US, good. Okay, so that's negative contingency protocol. That's another technique for doing this. Okay, so we've... Oh, I'm sorry. Yep.
I was just wondering, let's say you have, like, a little guy, and you have, like, a little guy.
Yep. I'm not quite sure what the lots of little cages...
Well, like, it's more than one context, like, it's not just one box that he's put into.
Oh, are the boxes all more or less the same? If the boxes are all more or less the same, then he probably can't tell them apart. If the boxes are that he's getting shocked in are inherently different, they have different contextual stimuli, then essentially he's learning multiple CS pluses. it's possible to do. I mean, the more and more of them you throw at the critter, the harder it's going to become. But it's it just means he has to learn lots of different CS pluses, is all.
So can we like a little habit drill thing like that? They don't know the difference between the different areas, but they can tell?
No, they probably... So if you got some sort of habit trail system, do they know the difference between different areas? They probably do, because there's probably different scent cues. There's probably different geometries. They can see out of, if it's a hamster and a habit trail, they can see out of them and see where they are in relation to the rest of the room. So to truly do something like that, you'd have to do a lot of controls to make sure that they really can't. Or you'd have to set it up in some way. But they're going to be able to distinguish between those different sections in a... If you got a hamster, so if you know you got your pet hamster at home and you're thinking of doing this, just no, of course not. It's like, hello, Hemi, we're going to do science today. I don't like it when she laughs like that. I've got a car battery and I've got sunflower seeds. Yeah, moving on. Do not hook up a car battery to a hamster. Don't do that. Okay, so we've hopefully produced a CS minus. We've used one of our techniques, and we have hopefully got a CS minus. How do we find out? How do we know? Remember, the CS minus is going to produce the absence of the conditional response. It's going to inhibit that. So testing for nothing is essentially what you're doing. So we present our stimulus that we think we've turned into a CS minus. And nothing happens. There is no CR. Woohoo! Wait a minute. Huh. We either have produced a CS minus, yay, no CR, or the subject didn't learn anything at all. And the subject's just going, what? There was a tone? I guess so, yeah. Maybe. Does that mean something? I don't know. I wasn't paying attention. So we got a little problem there. Right? You got to be able to distinguish the lack of something. You know, how do we measure? How do we actually measure nothing? So, you know, the absence of something is proof positive. Well, this is tricky. So, there's a few ways of doing this. There's probably a few more, but these are generally the most commonly utilized ones. First one, bidirectional response. If you have got a system, your conditioning system, where your CR and for the CS plus is going to be one thing, and your CR for the CS minus is going to be something completely opposite or very different, then you can make use of this. So this is bidirectional response utilized, something that's an opposing response. So perhaps a situation where it's approach or avoid. Okay? So... in that case, if the CS is leading the subject to avoid, pull back, move away from the stimulus, then that's something, you know, in that case there, we can actually, you know, it's not going over to the place where the food is being delivered. It's actually avoiding that portion of the cage. Then in that case, okay, you know, we can behaviorally say, you know, it's not the CR. It actually is something different. It's something that actually is detectable in that case. So it's not just the complete absence of a response. It's actually a different response. So that's one way of doing it. But, I mean, that really requires that you've got a system for which you've really got these opposing responses to the CS plus and the CS minus. We don't always have that. Summation test. In this case here, present our CS plus, measure the conditional response. So however you want, the magnitude, the latency, whatever, you know, probability of getting a conditional response, take your measurement. Then take and make a compound stimulus with your CS plus and the CS minus. Okay, so present them together. Measure for your conditional response. If you get either a reduction in the strength of your CR or perhaps the complete absence of the CR, then you go, great, excellent. We've got a CS minus. It's actually inhibited, impeded, reduced, completely stopped the CR that was being produced by the CS plus. It may not completely eliminate it, right? It may just be a reduction. Okay. Third, retardation of acquisition. Train your CS minus, then, with a novel stimulus. So it's like, right, here's this thing that we think is a CS minus. Now we're going to pair it up with a novel stimulus. I'm thinking of something else. Take our trained CS and take a completely new novel stimulus. There's another retardation test you can do here as well. I think I was a little bit retarded just to think of it there. So take your CS minus. Take a stimulus that you've never done any training with before. You are now going to do conditioning, classical conditioning, with both. In other words, you're going to take this novel stimulus and try to turn it into a CS plus, and you're going to take your CS minus and see if you can turn it into a CS plus as well. So what happens here is you're going to give this the same number of trials to your CS minus and your novel stimulus. You will measure I think I've just been conditioned about something. you will then measure the conditional response to each. So it's like we're going to do 20 trials with this novel stimulus with the US and 20 trials with the CS minus and the US. Measure the CR for both of them and find out which is stronger. Now, you would expect that if you've actually got a CS minus, that your novel stimulus here should produce a much stronger conditional response, right? Because the prior learning that your CS minus has acquired is going to interfere or inhibit learning about this new one. If you want, you have to extinguish your CS minus learning before you can start acquiring this new association. Okay. Now, I'm not. This works. I mean, this you certainly people use the retardation of acquisition. One of the things that you have to be a little bit careful about with this is your CS minus and your novel stimulus have to be extremely comparable. And they have to match for what's called equipotentiality. We'll talk more about that in a while. But some stimuli are more easily conditioned with others than other stimuli. Not all stimuli are equally conditionable. So, you know, we could have a situation where it's like, all right, my CS minus is a tone, and I'm just going to get a novel stimulus. I'll use a light. Okay, well, it could be in this particular, you know, species you're working with, your test subjects there, light may be really easily conditioned with this US. It's like something is really biologically predisposed for them. Off it goes. And so we get, woohoo, look, you know, huge, huge, huge conditional response to your novel stimulus. But the CS minus may not be conditionally or as conditionable. And so it's like, yeah, there we go. We're not getting much here. Well, how much of that is due to it being a CS minus? How much is that due to having this poor biologically predisposed fit between this stimulus and the US? So one has to be careful with that. Now, again, if you're working with things with like rats and pigeons and gerbils and whatnot, the common subjects, you can go back in the literature and take a look and hopefully pick things that are stimuli that are relatively equal in terms of their equipotentiality. But still, you're always running perhaps a little bit of a risk there. There's a hand someplace. Equipotentiality. I did use a funky word called equipotentiality. It means there's an equal potential for, or the concept was there was an equal potential for learning between all stimuli, which in fact is not true. Oh my gosh, Pavlov is wrong about something. Well, he's dead, so it's not bothering him too much. We'll come back to equipotentiality a bit more when we talk about taste aversion. Okay, now, I said before that backwards conditioning produces a whole range of responses. In some cases, we get hardly any learning at all. In other cases, we get CS pluses, and in other cases, we get CS minuses. Now, if we, where was it? Here was. you know, this looks a little bit like a backwards conditioning situation, you know. Now, it looks a little bit like that because I've started by putting a US first. If I'd, you know, blanked out, you know, if I started with a CS minus, then it might look more like a trace conditioning setup. But in fact, one way that has been sometimes used to produce CS minuses is to do backwards conditioning, especially for aversives. So if the US is a shock, it's been suggested, then the CS is going to at least tell when you're not going to get shocked. So that's a period of safety. So backwards conditioning is interesting. A study by Keith Lucas and Gutman in 1975 actually showed that backwards conditioning can be extremely powerful, but only under certain biologically relevant situations. So they said, let's imagine we've got this kind of setup. We've got a predator that is going to attack a prey item. So an antelope grazing out there in the Serengeti. A lion attacks from behind. The antelope doesn't see the lion coming, gets clawed, gets injured, gets mauled a bit, but manages to run off and escape. So in this case here, the pain from being clawed or bitten or whatnot precedes the sight of the lion. So the pain here is our US, and the lion becomes the CS. So this would be a backwards conditioning. So you experience the US first, the pain, antelope runs away, looks back, and sees the lion covered in blood and its claws, and the antelope goes, oh my, and bounds off. Okay. Darn that Disney for shooting Lion King 2 out here. Anyways, yeah, pretty sure Disney's going to sue me now. Great. I got to stop putting these podcasts up. Anyhow, so this would be backwards conditioning. All right? Now, just thinking about this from a kind of evolutionary perspective, it would be really great if antelopes could learn like that. You know, because that's kind of important, as opposed to the antelope going, yeah, I felt this pain. Afterwards, you know, I saw that lion, and I know it's backwards conditioning, and it sometimes doesn't produce very strong learning. Wow, it must have been something invisible that attacked me. I'm going to go back and ask the lion what happened. That antelope is taken out of the gene pool very quickly. So antelopes that can make that backwards connection, or any prey item, that's useful. Okay, that's going to be naturally selected for. So here's what Keith Lucas and Gutman did. Now, they did not work with antelopes and lions. It is very difficult to get a research grant. It says, yeah, I need 100 antelope and 6 lions, and what we're going to do is let the antelopes graze, and we'll see if the lions can attack them and claw them. What's going to keep the lion from actually just attacking and killing the antelope? Yeah, that could be. We'll put oven mitts on the lions, so they probably can't just kill them. It's like, isn't that ethically questionable? Okay, how about this? We'll use rats. Oh, okay, much better. So here's what they did. They used rats. They gave rats little sugar pellets. Rats like sweets. They like chocolate. They like sugars. They're particularly susceptible. You kind of have to watch them, or they'll you know balloon up to sort of volleyball-sized fur balls with little tiny wobbly legs and head on top of a ball of fur. I've seen these guys. You know, most Sprague Dolly rats, your little lab rats, healthy weight for an adult, maybe 800 grams, something like that, 800 grams. You know. You just let these guys go, and they just like Jabba the Hutt. It's like, you know, 2.5 kilos of rat. You need 2 hands. It's like, oh. Yeah, so low. You know, they're huge. It's just like, you know, they're like little rat pillows. So soft. Stop scratching. Okay. So you got to watch them with the sugars and the chocolates. You can get rats to do amazing thing once they figure out what chocolate is. You know, they'll do a lot of stuff for chocolate, especially the male rats. Somebody once told me that the smell in chocolate, the scent of chocolate, has a chemical composition that's close to a female rat pheromone. I've never been able to document that. I don't know if that's just like an urban myth, I don't know. Or, well, not an urban myth. It's like a science urban legend, I guess. A science legend. I still know what you fed your rat last summer. But I don't think it matters. I don't think it has to smell like a female rat because they like sugar. I mean, like little candy sprinkles or things that aren't chocolate. Once they figure out that it's sugar, they'll... if you don't want to get them fat, you can give them things like sweet and low, you know. So no nutritional value in it whatsoever. They'll actually starve themselves to death. Given a choice between eating food or eating the sweet and low, they'll preferentially go for things with no calories at all. And so you know, you got to pull them off that and start feeding them again. You'll famished rats there. Anyways, back to this. So they fed the rats sugar pellets. Okay, they're going to give a so that's like the antelope eating there in the grasslands. They're going to give a one-time electric shock. Okay, so that's like the lion attacking the antelope. The lights are going to go out for either 1, 5, 10, or 40 seconds, and a toy hedgehog was added, a little rubber dog squeaky toy. If you go by PetSmart, you can probably still find these. They've been around for like decades. It's cute little rubber, like green or yellow or orange or red or blue little rubber hedgehogs and squeak. They got all the spikes or things that dogs like to chew on, tear apart, and whatnot. And so they put one of these in the cage. So the rat's sitting there, you know, just eating away at the sugar pellets. Oh, this is great. Mom said I was an idiot to become a lab rat. But ha, 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 zap! Whoa! Lights go down. Lights come back up. Hedgehog. Okay. Bum, bum, bum. They observe. They then, you know, leave it like that for a while. And rat goes back to its home cage. Hedgehog goes, well, you know, back into a box someplace. And then they bring the rat back a day later. And it's got sugar pellets a day later. And it's got a hedgehog sitting in the corner of the cage. Now, here's our model then, right? If you haven't figured this out already. Sugar pellets is the grazing, the shock, the pain from the attack, from our predator. And our hedgehog is standing in for the lion. So that's the model we're using here. And the timing follows as well. Sugar pellets first, shock, lights out. The lights go out just to give the researcher time to put his hand in there quickly and pop the hedgehog in, okay? That's the only reason the lights are going out. Okay, just so you know, just so the rat doesn't see this hand of the researcher coming down and putting a hedgehog in. Okay. So, there are some control groups. First control group saw the hedgehog, so eating the sugar pellets, lights go out. Hey, who turned on the lights? They come back on, there's a hedgehog sitting there. Second control group, eating sugar pellets, get shocked, lights go out, lights come back on, nothing. Same as before. Okay? So those are the controls, important controls. Here's the guy. In the control groups, no backwards conditioning, nothing at all. In the 40-second lights-out situation, they didn't get backwards conditioning either. It seems this may just have been too long. It may have violated contiguity too much. But in the 1, 5, and 10-second light-out experimental groups, they did get backwards conditioning. In the presence of the hedgehog, the next day, the rats avoid it. They like to stay on the other side from the hedgehog as much as possible. And they spend a lot of time sort of glaring at it, looking over at it. And this interferes with their ability to eat the sugar pellets. So Keith Lucas-Gutman had been recording the amount of sugar pellets that were being consumed in a certain time. And their consumatory behavior decreases. Okay, this is how they're measuring. This is what they're using to measure their CR here. Okay, there's a reduction. They don't eat as much for the hedgehog's present because right, every time they've been down to eat some sugar pellet, right, the hedgehog could be running towards them to shock them. At least that's probably what the rat's thinking. So they seem to be afraid of this. The more worried they are that the hedgehog caused this, presumably, the less they're going to eat because you keep, you know, looking over at the hedgehog to make sure it's not getting any closer, which, of course, it's not because it's a rubber hedgehog. But there you go. So in this case here, this demonstrates that in certain circumstances, you know, these biologically relevant conditions, we can get very strong backwards conditioning. And we can get excitatory CS plus backwards conditioning here. Okay. So, nice study. I quite like this study. Very nicely done. Okay, so the conclusion here is that when we've got a biologically relevant conditional stimulus or biologically relevant conditional stimuli, these actually can cause excitatory backwards conditioning. Very, very strongly. And in this case here, I mean, the kind of conditioning they were getting is like what you would expect to get out of short delay, or even better. I mean, look, this is one trial learning, essentially. You know, they did this with a single shock. Usually one trial learning, we only usually see this kind of stuff with taste aversions. Okay? But again, in the same way with taste aversions are these very strong biologically relevant classical conditioning situations. I mean, normally it takes a bunch of CSUS pairings before we get before we're going to get a good strong conditioned response. I mean, it's something like, and different for different species, for something like, say, rabbits doing eye blink conditioning, this may take a few hundred pairings of the CS and the US. Rabbits hardly ever blink to begin with, so they're useful for that. But for something like this, I mean, you know, in this way, it's kind of comparable to the taste aversion results, in that we get this with a single trial. It's something that's very important for survival. Okay. Emotional conditioning. We're going to talk about emotional conditioning for a little bit here. And of course, you all know if you. I'm sorry, I got these notes up fairly late last night. It's the joy of not having, you know, had a month or two to prep for the course. But so if you haven't seen the notes yet, you know, you won't know who's coming. But if you have seen the notes, and if you actually think about this at all, you probably sense with emotional conditioning that Albert B., otherwise known as Little Albert, is going to be showing up in the near future here. And in fact, he will. So we're going to talk a little bit about emotional conditioning here. There's a very wide range of emotional responses that humans can do. Although when we actually break this down, it really comes down to about six universal emotions here. Ekman in the late 60s demonstrated this very nicely when he'd take pictures of Caucasians showing fear, disgust, anger, surprise, happiness, these sorts of things. And we would tromp out into the jungles of Borneo and New Guinea highlands and show these pictures to indigenous peoples who'd had minimal contact with Westerners before, and they're all going, yep, fear, surprise, anger, disgust, happiness. I mean, their interpretations for why they might be, you know, showing these emotions might be different, right? Oh, disgust, stepped in a pile of bat guano, happiness, found a tarantula they could eat, you know, whatever. Probably someone from New York's probably knows, tarantula, hey! That's probably going to, you know, disgust. But still, they had no problem identifying the emotions. So emotions are universal in this sense. And we talk about positive and negative emotions. The emotional response then, the generation of these emotional responses are reflexive. Certain stimuli are highly likely to produce specific emotional responses. Very innate, very hardwired, very, in this sense, as I said, very reflexive. But we can also condition emotional responses. So we can use classical conditioning to produce an emotional response to some stimulus. So these are called conditioned emotional responses. The psychology work on this goes back to this guy, John Brodus Watson. Well known for being, well, for lots of reasons, but 1913 published a book on behaviorism where he promoted his school of thought on psychology, which is called behaviorism, or been come to be called hardline behaviorism. He was very much in the British empiricist philosophical school of thought. If you were able to, you know, resuscitate Watson from beyond the grave here and talk to him, he would definitely say that it was the nurture over the nature. It's learning that's most important. He didn't say that there were no innate behavioral processes. I mean, he's working in terms of classical conditioning. Obviously, there have to be some reflexes out there. But he thought in terms of most of the more complicated things that people would do, besides some really base level reflexes, he felt the most significant thing was going to be learning. Okay, started out during this early work with rats, so trained in a very traditional comparative psychology, you know, Thorndikean sort of approach to experimental research there. And after he joined the faculty at Johns Hopkins University, he started working with infants, human infants, got interest in human infant research. Johns Hopkins University. At this time, it was actually not that large of a university. It's quite a famous university now, medical university. It was fairly small at the time. Didn't have a huge amount of money at the time there. But it was a medical research university. And as such, also, it was just had a hospital associated with it. And many women would, in the area, just go there to deliver their babies. And as such, as well, also, back in the early 20th century, I mean, nowadays, you go to a hospital, you deliver a baby, you're kind of out the door, generally within a few hours, sort of thing, either if you want to or not. Given the choice, getting out can be really good, it's no problem. But back in the early 20th century, it wasn't unusual to have women stay in hospital after giving birth for 12, 15, 18 days. And so as such, there was a lot of babies at the hospital. And Watson was able to make connections with many of the women that would deliver at the hospital and say, well, come on back at some point in the future when the child is such and such age, would you be willing to take part in research projects. So had a good access to infants there. Getting access, for anyone that is interested in developmental psychology, trying to get access to a large sample set of infants can be very difficult. You really got to kind of, troll around and, beat the forest there to get the kids to be driven out and find adults that are, parents will bring them in. So this was fortunate for Watson. He was able to do this. And there was other people at Johns Hopkins that were researching with infants as well. So he wasn't just some crazy guy there on his own doing weird stuff with kids. One of the things I think that in part drove some of his work with respect to infants, he didn't seem to actually like kids all that much. Interestingly enough, he was a fairly I don't want to call him cold with respect to his own children, but he was not massively involved with them when they were younger, left that to his wives. But he was very opposed to psychological schools of thought that included introspectionism and Freudian theorizing. Introspectionist was a European approach to try to understand what's happening in the mind by getting people just to report on their emotions or their thought processes. And the kind of stuff that was produced by introspectionism was kind of random. So, their subjects, their human subjects, would go through rigorous training techniques to be able to accurately report their interior mental thought processes. And, the subjects come up with all kinds of different stuff. Just like load a shotgun with buckshot, aim it at a graph, and shoot it, and you'll get data points everywhere. And Watson thought this was bunk. He didn't think this was science at all. He figured that the chemists and physicists were out there laughing at psychologists because of this sort of stuff. He also just had a massive hate-on for Freudian theories. He just loathed Freudian interpretations, which is odd because I actually have seen some articles sort of linking that some of his ideas may in fact have an underlying Freudian flavor to them. But still, he felt that there was massive problems with Freudians and went out of his way to poke fun at Freudian theories when he could. In his Watson-Rayner article in 1920, he certainly does that in the end part of it. He says, now, imagine that, at some point in the future, some man comes into a Freudian psychoanalyst and says, hey, doctor, I'm afraid of furry things. What's going on? The Freudian will say, that's undoubtedly because, you would have been exposed to your mother's pubic hair when you were a child, so that's what it's costed, eh? And, Watson says, in reality, it's just because I was giving this kid a rat and banging on a metal bar behind his head to condition a fear. So, even in this article, he likes kind of hitting to the Freudians there. Anyways, so he says, right, I'm going to prove that the Freudians are full of bunk. I'm going to actually condition, using classical conditioning, I'm going to condition a fear response. And then I'm going to extinguish it. You know, then I'll do something else. And he says, it's all going to be due to the learning process. It's not going to be some sort of innate, internal ego, superego, and id things going on. Okay, so he gets access to a kid that he calls, in the article, Albert B. Now, from the article, and he wrote about this in a few other places over the years, we know that Albert's mother was a wet nurse working at the Harriet Lane home for mothers that had just delivered babies. And this, the Harriet Lane home was attached to the Johns Hopkins University, part of the medical center there. So she was employed to do this. She had a son who was about 8 months old at the time that Watson and Rayner started the study, and she agreed to let them make use of the child. They assessed Albert initially at about 8 months of age, and they found him to be very emotionally stable and healthy. Watson liked Albert, working with Albert for this, because he was emotionally stable. He was concerned that if the child was like, seems to be very prone to panic in response to new stimuli, then this would confound his classical conditioning of a fear response. Okay, so everything about Albert seems normal, fairly emotionally stoic. Great. Here's what they did. They presented a white rat. Okay, so they give Albert a white rat, put it in front of him there, and there's no apparent fear. All right. Then they present a white rat to Albert, and Watson stands behind Albert, out of sight, and bangs on a metal bar with a hammer, producing a loud noise. This frightens, startles Albert, produces fear. So this produces a conditioned emotional response of fear, causes Albert to avoid the rat when they subsequently give Albert a rat. So test trials, here's a rat, and it's like, ah, he pulls back. As he gets older and is able to crawl, he tries to take off, and so he gets withdrawal responses there. So he says, yeah, I'm going to call it fear. Okay? So Albert now seems to be afraid. So the US is the noise, the UR is the startled response, the CS is the rat, or possibly just the fur on the rat. It's a little bit, you know, people can quibble about the details here. And the CR is the fear. Now, what I'm saying, it's the rat or maybe just the fur, the furry thing, because Watson and Rayner then give Albert a series of other furry items, furry objects, a dog, a fur coat, Santa Claus mask. Watson sticks his head down by Albert, so hair, and Albert tries to withdraw from all of these. Now, interestingly, what do you mean it can't be found? Bugger. Okay, hold on a second here. I should be able to get this quickly. Oh, wait a second. Wait, I was connected. Okay, hold on. Let me try to... that's odd. Maybe I timed out. So he actually filmed parts of what he was doing with Albert. This got lost for a while. The film sort of got lost for a while, then refound and whatnot. He unfortunately didn't film everything, or perhaps not everything has been recovered over the years. And so we don't actually have the segment where he's producing the U.S., giving the U.S. loud noise. So this is part of it here.
In the early part of the 20th century, psychologists John Watson and Rosalie Rayner set out to teach a baby boy called Little Albert to fear white rats using the principle of classical conditioning. This is a film of their work. The film.
So he doesn't seem really particularly bothered by, you know, things like monkeys being dangled on strings in front of him there at this point.
It shows several phases of their study. First, as you see here, the investigators demonstrated that prior to conditioning, little Albert had no fears of any animal, including, of course, white rats.
Said, ah, in my face, but otherwise, you know. It's in Watson's face, too. Yeah, whatever. It's a paw. There's the rat. There's a version or two of this up on the on YouTube as well, where they show this same film, but they've put in noises to this segment. So they've faked the loud noise. So just if you go poking around for this stuff or whatnot, or someone tells you about this, we don't actually have the conditioning component. This is, again, the pre-testing. Yeah, he's trying to pet the rat, so, you know. I have no idea where Watson was getting all this stuff. It's just like walking outside. It's like, ah, bunny! Excellent! Goes back inside. Dog! Look, a monkey's going by.
Watson and Rayner then sought to teach Albert to fear white rats through classical conditioning. In the conditioning phase of the study, which was not filmed, the investigators struck a steel bar with a hammer whenever Albert reached for a rat, making a very loud noise that greatly upset and frightened Albert. After six such hearings of the loud noise in the rat, it was believed that the boy had been conditioned to fear white rats. That is, Albert was now expected to react fearfully to white rats, whether the rats were paired with loud noises or not. In this next film sequence, we see Albert interacting with a white rat after the conditioning process. The investigators believe that the child's reaction during this trial demonstrated his newly acquired fear of white rats.
He's crying now.
Finally, the investigators expected that little Albert's conditioned fear of white rats would generalize the stimuli that were similar in key ways to a white rat. In this film segment, they were trying to demonstrate that the child now also reacted fearfully to similar objects, such as a rabbit, a dog, a rat mask.
I think the dog's like been conditioned to fear children. It's like, I'm not going near that thing. Yeah. This was just something that, I think it was a fur stole or a fur coat here. Now, this is actually a terrifying mask in any way, but it's supposed to be a Santa Claus mask. Christmas forever ruined. Okay. So, let's bring the lights back up. Why don't we take a 10-minute break?